message. So just going on from yesterday's class, the right mindfulness. Basically, the four focuses of mindfulness. So now we have the eight factors of the Eightfold Path, Samasamadhi, usually rendered concentration, but it's much preferred to use the word stillness. The right stillness. Now, first of all, we have, I remember this is from the Mahasamsika Sutta. This is the Majjhima 36. And this was the story from the story of the Buddhist Enlightenment. I remember the time when my father was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Having passed beyond the five senses and free from unwholesome states, I entered the mind in the first jhana. I thought, this was him recalling after his ascetic practice and getting older, I thought, could that be the path to enlightenment, Bodhi? Then the realization arose, that jhana is indeed the path to enlightenment. It's a path, when you actually translate it that way, the jhanas are a path to enlightenment. So, can you scroll down, please? And now we have what these four jhanas are. Having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses, for those of you who know, for any of you know the bodies, we reach a one kamehi. That's kamehi does not mean the sense pleasures, it means the five senses. It means the five senses have disappeared. The unwholesome states are these five hindrances. Totally, having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses, free from unwholesome states, you enter upon the mind in the first jhana. And the factors of that first jhana, when the mind moves on to the object and holds on to it, the object being the joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. There is the object in the jhanas is bliss, ecstasy, incredible pleasure, piti sukha. And as it says in that, vivekaja, piti sukha, which means the joy, the bliss, which is comes from the seclusion, being away from, separated from, in this particular case, the five senses. When people ask where does the insight practice come with these jhanas, it's just indulging, it's not. Because that particular piece of happiness, the joy, the bliss, comes from these bodily functions of the senses totally vanishing. And it's like an affliction, it's like a burden being let go of. You feel free. And it's a bliss of such freedom from the five senses. It's so typical when you read cases of people having out of body experiences that they feel just so free and peaceful and happy and joyful outside of their body. One of the first records of that which I remember seeing, which was fascinating because it was a person who was not a Buddhist, not a Hindu. It was one of the senators in the Australian Parliament who told a story that when he was in Vietnam fighting in that war, that he stepped on a landmine and off his legs. He described what happened next. And brilliant flash of light, that was a bomb going off, incredible, unbearable pain. And a second later, in his words, floating above the paddy fields of Vietnam without a care in the world, the most happy feeling he's ever experienced. It's just weird that he just lost your legs. He was just actually free out of body experience. And that's so typical. And this is only still got the mind and made body. In the jhanas, it is so happy. And that is the object there. And where it says the mind moves on to the object and holds on to it, I'm not sure if you'll understand this, but you have that beautiful object of this, and there is still the mind is still holding on to it, slightly, ever so slightly, for any grasping, any doing, disturbs the stillness, and basically the object starts to become unstable. We actually move away from the jhana, and then it's so good we get drawn back in straight away. It's what I call a wobble in the first jhana. The mind moving onto the object and holding onto it, because it holds onto it, it goes back again. It's not that stable. It's still a master of doing that. Now in the first jhana, five things are absent and five factors are present. When one has entered the first jhana, five hindrances are certainly absent. And what is present? The mind moves on to the object. That is called vitakka, holds on to it, vichara, the object being joy and pleasure, and it's a oneness of mind. When you talk about a oneness of mind, both perception of not being over here or over there, but still, and also oneness in time, it lasts a long period of time. Not just the idea of oneness in space, but oneness in time. And that becomes what we call the first jhana. And sometimes it's difficult for people to know whether it's the first jhana or not. Some of the signs are that you cannot hear sound, you cannot feel the body, you cannot think. And if the thought comes, is this first jhana? It can't be. The mind is not that coarse to have thoughts. It's only after you come out, wow, that was amazing, that was incredible, what was that? And after a while, a bit more letting go, you don't need to hold on to the joy and pleasure. You do the final tiny bit more letting go, and you get to the second jhana, when the mind no longer moves onto the object because it's let go of holding onto it. Let's see, vichara vanishes. You enter upon the mind in the second jhana, which has trust. This is the word samprasada, sometimes called confidence. To be able to let go, you have to have a lot of trust. Well, there's three cups of tea. This is amazing, it's triple dip. Very good. See, I told you, you don't go searching for things. If you go chasing a cup of tea, it always runs away from you. If you sit perfectly still, just like the donkey and the carrot, the tea comes to you. But anyway, the mind moves on to the where we go. Set it off holding on, you enter upon the mind of the second jhana, you really are letting go totally here. And the sign of that is it has trust, you don't have to do things. Sometimes I've noticed trying to get as many similes from life as I possibly can. Sometimes, because of some bad karma, I have to go into a shopping center to do something like that. It's usually actually to go to a food court to get lunch when you're late and nothing else is open, before 12 o'clock in clips. And sometimes I'm amazed. I see mothers carrying their baby and a shopping trolley or something. And there's lots of people there and the baby is fast asleep in the mother's arms. Well, it's such a dangerous noisy place. Could you do that? I'd be so scared. Mother's going to drop me or I was going to bang into something. But a mother, so a baby, trusts her mother so much. And go fast asleep, no matter what's happening around it. It's a sign of life, letting go, born of trust. So here you trust so much, that's the samprasada, sometimes called confidence. That you let go of holding onto yet upon the mind, the second time, which has trusted the object for this, enough to let go of holding it, you know it's going to stay there, you don't need to keep grabbing onto it. And a unity of mind without any movement or holding. With joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. It's called like samadhi jhana, bliss. The bliss born of stillness. Nothing moves anymore. So the second jhana is much easier for you to recognize because nothing moves at all. Like a rock, like a diamond. It doesn't shake at all. It's there, perfectly still. And the deeper the jhana, the longer it lasts, because it's so incredibly stable. Now this is where somebody asks a question, what's the difference between the joy and the happiness of Bhikkhu Sutta? what happens next is, because things are still, some things begin to fade away. Just like I mentioned that in that Zen monastery, I looked at the wall with my eyes open because nothing was moving, the wall disappeared. From stillness, things vanish. So, because there's an absolute stillness here, things start to disappear. The first thing which disappears is that part of the experience called joy. So your mind might not fully aware experiencing of bliss, which is purified from joy. You enter upon the mind in the second, in the third jhana, on account of which no one can ask what has the pleasant abiding indeed where such mindfulness and equanimity. It's mindful here. Sometimes people say, oh, the jhana is not mindful at all, you disappear, you blacked out. That's not the case, you're not blanking out, your mindfulness is incredibly strong now. And another simile of these jhanas is like different flavors of ice cream. The first one is one flavor of bliss and happiness, and the second one is much more delicious. And the third one is even more delicious than that. It is the coarser part of the ecstasy, which is this thing they call the piti, the joy, has disappeared. But it's soft, smooth happiness. And these are blisses, happinesses that most people don't know even exist. Getting more and more satisfied. And having abandoned facial pain, all the experience of the five senses, and the disappearance of joy and happiness, the abandonment from the sixth sense, except for equanimity, you enter upon the mind in the fourth garden, which has only neutral mental experience remaining. That even the sukha, the happiness, has disappeared. Just pure mindfulness with equanimity. But even though the sukha, the happiness, has disappeared, in another place also, actually, this is even more happiness. The happiness, but happiness is gone. It becomes even more refined, more satisfied. And it's even called equanimity happiness. It just gets deeper and deeper. If you want to look at it right away, this is an investigation into the nature of happiness and how refined it could be and how satisfying and beautiful it can be. This, again, trying to find crazy similes. When I was young, I loved rock music. As you grew older, you started to appreciate more refined music. You know, like classical music. But even just really, I call it hard classical music, like Beethoven. After a while, I liked even softer ones. I remember one of my favorites was, I don't know, many may not know him, Monteverdi. But my taste in music got more and more refined. Until now, if only want to listen to music, it's the sound of the wind in the trees, it's even more refined than whatever any composer could create. And of course, even better than that is the sound of the silence. The government's humming a hunkle's better. I mean, really silence, gorgeous. So just as your taste in music refines, your taste in pleasure refines. When you're a meditator, you actually appreciate the most refined happinesses when things are vanished. But the fourth jhana is equanimity. You enter upon the mind, you enter upon the mind, the fourth jhana, which is only neutral spirit, just pure mindfulness and equanimity. This is the peak of mindfulness. Mindfulness can't get any more than this. It's not disturbed, it's incredibly bright, no hindrances, nothing moving, really deep disturbed. Those are four jhanas. The deep, powerful stillnesses. Now before I go further, I'd like to have other anecdotes of these deep meditations, because sometimes people ask the question, do they experience jhanas in some of the other religions and paths? And it is my understanding from what I have read and learnt that these jhanas were actually started by the Buddha. He was the one who said, who discover these things. And one of the reasons is because it takes a lot of letting go, but a commitment to the happiness of the mind. It's not letting go of all happiness, because too often the people are too austere and ascetic to get into these jhanas. That is one of the reasons why when the Buddha realized this was the path of enlightenment, he also realized that you cannot attain these jhanas if you are weak, unhealthy, tired. And that is why the Buddha gave up his ascetic practices. He starts to eat properly, starts to look after his body, bathe it, and chose a place to meditate, which was, if you've ever been to Bodhgaya, a very pleasant parkland by the river. Very quiet and serene. I was fortunate enough to go visit Bodhgaya the first time in 1972 or 1973. That is very different than what you see today. There's hardly anybody there. The only way to get there was to get through the town of Gaya and just get a Parasanga ritual for the day. And you got there was nothing there. No place to eat, nothing. Just these quiet sites. Of course, there's a few temples that I should have known about to get something to eat, but at the time, there's hardly anyone there at all. And I could imagine what it was like in the time of the Buddha. No buildings, just the river and the garden. And it was tranquil, peaceful. I always mentioned that this was not an austere practice. In fact, when the Buddha started eating properly and bathing and looking after his body, his first five disciples thought he'd abandoned and given up the quest for enlightenment. They left him because they were disillusioned with it. The idea at that time, as it is even these times, no pain, no gain. Especially in religious life. So, that degree of austerity is an obstacle. Of course, the first teaching the Buddha gave up is enlightenment, the middle way. And the first of those middle ways, Atikalamatari Yoga, is practices which tire and weary the mind and the body. So anything like sleeping too much or not sleeping at all, then first make you tired of sleeping. So eating the right amount, not too much, find it just the right amount, so you feel healthy, you feel good. But unfortunately, too often people push themselves. And that's not the way. Anyway, and what kind of meditation, just to make the point, these jhanas are what the meditation really means. This is from the Gopika Moggallana Sutta. And that was after the Buddha passed away, the Ananda, after he entered the key through the keyhole, was enlightened and got some authority, he was the go-to person. And when people wanted to ask questions, because he'd been associated with the Buddha for the last 25 years, another Buddha passed away, when people wanted to ask him questions, he was the one to answer them. So in particular, they asked him, well, what kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? And the Ananda answered, totally free from the five senses, you're abiding in the first jhana. When the mind starts moving onto the joy of taking and stops holding it, your mind in the second jhana, the fading away of joy, you find in the third jhana, the burning of all mental pleasant and unpleasant vedana, you find in the fourth jhana. The Buddha only prays these four kinds of meditation. So that's pretty clear that that's what the Buddha intended people to do. The meditation which actually leads to the life. And to answer one of the questions or complaints people have, these meditations are so pleasurable, won't you get attached? And this is Madhika Nikaya Prasada Sutta. The Arjuna, this is the Buddha asking these questions to this Arjuna. These four kinds of life devoted to pleasure that are entirely conducive to repulsion from the world. the things fading away into cessation, peace, realization, enlightenment, and nirvana. These four kinds of life devoted to pleasure that are conducive to enlightenment. What are they? The four jhanas. So if devotees of other sects should say that the Buddhists are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told, yes, we are addicted to four types of pleasure seeking. Why? And, well, they would be speaking correctly about you. Then some people might further ask you, what benefits can you expect from a life attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking? You should require that they can expect only four fruits, four benefits, three winning, one returning, not returning, or full enlightenment. Those are the four stages of enlightenment. These are the benefits that you can expect from being attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking. So being attached to jhanas, that's where it leads. Okay, you can scroll down a little bit. Oh, I never actually mentioned about the can it happen in other religions. And yes, it can. It does seem to be. But seems to be the Buddha found this out. First of all, other people catch quotation against it to these states. So, a couple of people who seem to be able to do this, from historical research, was two of the Christian saints, Saint Teresa of Avila and Saint John of the Cross. And the reason I say this is because reading through some of their descriptions of what they experienced, it's very hard to get a good translation of what they experienced. Is in all translations, the translator adds a lot. But it does seem to be that they went missing out. And the main part, which is interesting for anybody who wants to attain this journey, is how did these Christians attain that? They surrendered to the idea of God. Surrender to the Almighty. But they did it 100%. What does that mean? They let go of their own will. Basically, that they imagine being driven in a car and letting God take the steering wheel. They were letting go, totally, surrendering. And of course, they had the faith and trust to do that. And so many of them would have experienced that first jhana. If any of you have ever experienced that first journey, you can understand why they will call that union with God. Incredible bliss, really powerful, more happiness than you've ever seen before. Your idea of yourself totally vanished, you can't think, your body's vanished and disappeared, and also that you can't really move. You have to be still. Your will, which defines you, has disappeared. And so many people, if you haven't known or been taught that there's much more before, beyond that first jhana, second, third, fourth, and beyond, many people would feel that that is the ultimate experience. A union with God, a union with Brahma, whatever it is with the Paramatma, if you haven't had more instructions. Powerful, biggest experience of your life. And as, because I've got a funny sense of humour, I often say that as a Buddhist, if you get into, say, a first jhana, you don't get the same respect as you would get in other religions. But in Buddhism, it's just the first jhana. But if you were a Christian who went into the first jhana, you would be made a saint, and they would name schools and hospitals after you. It would be St. PJ's Hospital in Singapore. Because you tell us, you're dealing with God. Wow, amazing, you're a saint. But anyway, that's what, you can imagine what it's like. And the most important thing, in those Christians, in the Middle Ages, I haven't seen any Christians getting even close to that these days. But it was the case many years ago that they really did total surrender, 100%. They couldn't let go. And that is why
I think these monks and nuns in the time, hundreds of years ago, could manage those things. St. Teresa revealed it, she was levitating all over the place. So in the church, when there was something going on, she came into a deep meditation, and said the nuns had to really keep their eyes open and grab her by the legs to stop her floating up into the rafters, which is really cool. So, we haven't got any rafters here, but we do have, in the centre over here, these little bars over here you can hang on to. So if any of you do that, hang on to those and they'll land it up. But that actually happens. So, okay, and this is from the Mahamalukya Puja Sutra, because people ask, can you get another way to get enlightened? Can you get enlightened without jhanas? Because there is a tradition which says, sukha vipassana, just bare insight path, which unfortunately is gone now. It doesn't exist. Fortunately, these days, you don't have to believe me. You can get the sutras online, especially if you have them in the Pali. You don't have to understand Pali, but just do a word search. And Sukha Vipassana. Does that word exist anywhere in the sutras? And you find it doesn't exist anyway. You say it afterwards. So the thing doesn't exist. There is one path only, and there is one way to abandon the five fetters. Haven't actually talked about the five fetters. The five lower fetters are what stop you being a monitor. I don't know how much of that dummy you know. The three fetters are abandoned for being a screen winner, and that is personality, view, the idea there's a permanent essence somewhere. And the belief in rites and rituals will be enough to get you to enlightenment and skeptical doubt. Those are the first three of the fetters. The next two fetters are weakened for the once-returner and totally abandoned for the non-returner, the third stage of enlightenment. And those two fetters are craving, wanting, connected to the five senses, and aversion. Kama, Chanda, and Vayapada. And after that, the next five fetters are abandoned to make the last transition from non-eternity for enlightenment. And here we're talking about overcoming the first five basic fetters. There is one path only, Ananda, one way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. It is impossible that anyone can understand or abandon these five basic fetters without relying on that path. No more than it is possible to cut out the hardwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sapwood. And probably just like me, when I saw that simile, just because I'm rebellious, I started thinking, what is another way to get at the hardwood without going through the bark and sapwood? And I thought maybe you go through the roots, just go up the roots and then actually get in that way. Or maybe go through the leaves. But look, it's very clear what the Buddha's saying, that you can't get to the hardwood of a tree except going through the bark and the sapwood. So there's no way, no more than it's possible to cut the hardwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sapwood, so you can't abandon the five fetters. What is that path? The four jhanas, and also the three immaterial attainments, which are based on those four jhanas. And also says, while you still do not experience jhana, this is actually, I have got the quote here, because this is from, I saw, I think, one of the first few sutras, in the first 10 anyway. I've got it here, Majjhima 68, here it is. While you still do not experience jhana, the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invade your mind and remain. When you do experience the jhana, the five hindrances, discontent and weariness do not invade your mind and remain. So in other words, one of the jobs of the jhanas is searching to get rid of the five hindrances. So first before, but afterwards they're gone for a long period of time. I've been teaching this for such a long time, and always says that in the jhanas you cannot become enlightened, because your mind can't move, it's too still. But the job of the jhanas is to totally eradicate the five hindrances for a long period of time. And also, based on experience, what happens in those jhanas, the data you collect, together with the absence of the five hindrances afterwards, is where the really powerful insights come. That time, just after the jhana has finished, the commentaries, the sutras never say this, but it's fair enough, is they call it upachara stillness. Like the neighborhood stillness. And in other words, just after the jhana is finished, or just before the jhana. Five hindrances are gone, that is the time you get insight. But of course, the five hindrances go just before you enter jhana, and also after you enter jhana. After you enter jhana, when you emerge from jhana. That's the neighborhood. It's like the doormat. It was a doormat coming into this hall. You have to go over it to get in, and you also step over it to go out. That's called the upachara. And it is feasible that before you get into jhana, your five hindrances are gone, and maybe you can get some insight. But when the five hindrances have disappeared prior to the jhana, that's really unstable. And I can't really understand how anybody who has the door open into jhanas would enter that door, have a strong jhana, and afterwards the five hindrances have gone for a long period of time. Just before jhana, the five hindrances are stuck. So they get up pretty quickly. After jhana, they've gone for a long time. And I was always wondering, because Ajahn Chah would never talk much about those jhanas. And some of the people who were studying with him said he didn't encourage jhanas. And I was a bit concerned about this, because he was my teacher. But recently, when I was in Thailand last February, and I had an appointment which was cancelled, so I had a free day. And so I took the opportunity to go and visit a monk, a Western monk, his junior to me, called Ajahn Chah Saro. And he was finishing compiling the English translation of the biography of Ajahn Chah. And to be able to complete that biography, he had to listen to so many recorded talks in Thai of Ajahn Chah, so many of them. And so he was listening to these. I may have heard these talks, but couldn't remember them. And I asked him, he said, some people say Ajahn Chah never taught these jhanas. You know, you've probably listened to so many talks of Ajahn Chah even before you even went there. You know, you've got all the old recordings, some on tapes, on the old reel tapes. He said, is that true? You never taught jhanas? He said, it's actually not true at all. He did teach those jhanas. He called them apana. It was a commentary word for the jhanas. And I said, what about, you know, what people say, the only place you can get insight, you know, is in the upachara. I said, exactly. But even Ajahn Chah said that the upachara samadhi, the best one to use, is that which is post-jhana. That's when people get enlightened. And I was so actually pleased, this is the personal thing, I was so pleased. Well, you know, what I discovered was in the sutras, you know, is what even Ajahn Chah taught as well. Then the jhanas, after the jhanas, hindrances have gone for a long period of time. And you have this amazing data, which I'm going to probably talk about later on, tomorrow. The data by which you can get real, deep, powerful insight. So that's why this is. Path through life. And you may say, oh, it's way beyond me, jhanas. No, it is not. beyond you. We sin like that, of course we never do this. You say, well, I don't want to get enlightened. Why not? Here from the time of the Buddha was 3 minutes, watch the turns, come the turns, so why not you? It's my stupid idea of equity, egalitarianism. Why not? So anyway, when you still don't experience Dharma, the five hindrances together with discontent and weariness invade your mind and remain. That's a very powerful one as well. Get the jhanas, full energy, not weary. This is what happens. It's ridiculous when I talk about this, but sometimes as your monkey come out of jhanas, even at my age, I think I could give you St. Paul for lunch this month at 100 meters. Now honestly, you feel that powerful. You know, no weariness at all. Wow, you can do whatever. Well, I think maybe you say Bob might win. But that's how it feels. No weariness at all, you're totally energized. And discontent, you're just happy for days. That's one of the ways you can tell if a person takes I'll tell you the tricks. Say one of you comes up and says, you know, you've got jhanas. And again, I might still say to you, I'm sorry, women can't get jhanas, only men can. Now look at you. If you really get upset, sorry, that wasn't a jhana. I don't believe it. Of course women can get jhanas as well as men, but I'm doing that to see if you have discontent about what you hear. I try to wind you up, try to make you upset and angry. Because if you do get angry and upset, I'm sorry, that wasn't a jhana. If it really is a jhana, afterwards you can't get wound up, you can't get angry. No way. You're just so happy, so content. People can say anything to you. And that just doesn't affect you. That's a good sign. That's why when you get the jhanas, the discontent and weariness don't invade the mind. Now also, this is the Anguttara Nikaya. I can't see the Ada. This is in the Anguttara Nikaya. This is a collection of suttas according to five hindrances, four noble truths, eightfold paths, whatever. So the eight there is, it's a group of eights in here somewhere. And this is Anguttara 8, Sutta 81. When you have no jhana, for one deficient in jhana, the cause for seeing things as they truly are is destroyed. This is so common, that the cause for seeing things as they truly are is called yatha bhuta, as things are. Yatha bhuta, jnana dasana is wisdom, seeing things as they really are, not as they appear to be, not as they want, you want them to be, not as you're afraid they might be, but seeing as they truly are, only through stillness. The life stillness of jhana. When you have no jhana, for one deficient jhana, the cause of seeing things as they truly are is not being destroyed. When you do not see things as they truly are, for one deficient in such wisdom, the cause for repulsion, turning away from the world and fading away, is destroyed. When you're not repulsed or inclined to disappear, for one deficient in these, the cause for knowledge, division, and liberation is destroyed. In other words, jhana leads to wisdom, wisdom leads to things disappearing. And when things disappear, you get enlightened. Next one, develop jhana. Again, this is from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Develop jhana. When you experience jhana, you can understand things as they really are. And what you understand as it really is, the origin and passing away of form, that's the first candy. You understand the origin and passing away of experience, the origin and passing away of perception, the origin and passing away of the will, and the origin and passing away of the consciousnesses. How do you understand those? Because those things are what disappears in the jhanas. You've got experience of things vanishing, which aren't supposed to vanish. And lastly, this is from the Dharmapada, verse 372. I quote this so often, it's so clear. There is no jhana for one without wisdom. You use wisdom powers to get the jhanas. There is no wisdom for one without jhanas. The jhana also creates wisdom. For one who has both jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nirvana. This is so close. I love that one. What's next? Okay, I thought that was the last one here. So, just summing up. This is the middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, to knowledge, which leads to peace, direct knowledge to enlightenment, to nirvana. Enter upon this path and make an end of suffering. And okay, we've got the time. Let's talk about nirvana. When you know and see thus, the mind is no longer pulled out into the world of the five senses. It is liberated from the wanting. Asman is outflowing. Why can't one just stay inside and be nice and peaceful? Why does the world always pull you out? It is because this outflow, this habit of always going to look for your pleasures and satisfaction in the world. It is no longer flows out just to be. It is liberated from the outflow, the attachment of existence. Sometimes when you start talking about nirvana, cessation, people think, oh, but can I enjoy nirvana when it's there? You mean I just have to vanish completely off all that hard work? I can't sort of hang out there for a while and enjoy myself? No, you've got to vanish. Cease to be. If it was there, I don't want that. The reason is because we just understand existence and being. So we're afraid to let it go. I see that very often when I visit people sort of in hospitals or the ICU. Sometimes they can't die. Even though they're in great pain and discomfort. Why? It doesn't matter what religion they are. Unless they've got some really deep understanding or knowledge, they're afraid of death. They'd rather be and experience pain than actually not be and be free of pain. Your attachment to existence is huge. It is a fundamental attachment, the attachment to be. The idea of you vanishing, disappearing, it's a very hard one to understand, let alone to actually actualize. But what happens is you get these balance that you don't exist for a little while. You come back again and say, that was really cool. What am I afraid of? Anyway, it's no longer flows out just to be. It's no longer leaks out because of delusion. It's liberated from delusions. When liberation occurs, the knowledge of liberation invariably follows. So, it invariably follows. You can't be enlightened not knowing. When enlightenment happens, the knowledge of enlightenment is the next stage. Next one. You understand. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more rebirth or reappearance in any state of existence. Your deliverance is unshakable. This is your last life. Now there will be no renewal of existence. For this is the supreme noble wisdom and the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. We go to true goal. So this holy life does not have gain, honor, and fame for its main purpose, or the attainment of virtue for its main purpose, or the maintainment of jhana for its main purpose, nor insight for its main purpose. The main purpose of the holy life is the unshakable deliverance of mind, full enlightenment. This is the goal of this holy life, its essence and culmination. Maybe you will think, the teacher's instruction has ceased. Now we have no teacher. It should not be seen like this. What I have taught in Spain was a dominant discipline. Will of my passing be your teacher? So, unlike other religions, where the Buddha passed away, said, I'm not going to anoint a successor. There's no going to be Buddha number two, or Buddha the third, like Queen Elizabeth II, King George the 17th, or whatever it is. So So he said, no, no more leaders. The teachings are your leader. No, a very powerful statement which changed the whole way the Buddha is presented. We do not have any popes. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has got no power. No one has. Because it's the teaching of the Buddha. That is our leader. That is our guru. That is our boss. That's our pope. Teachers, not a teacher. That's very powerful. It means that Buddhism never actually became a hierarchy. People have tried to make it a hierarchy many times, but because of sayings like that, it always fails. You can't have a hierarchy. The Buddha says, no monk, no nun, no matter even how enlightened they are, will be your teacher. The Dharma discipline is a teacher. I am not your teacher. The Dharma and the discipline, that's your teacher. Do you remember that? All you have to do is encourage you. I'm your motivator, your coach. Your main teacher is the Dharma, what you hear, what you see here. So you should live with islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as your island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. For these reasons, those matters I have discovered and proclaimed should be carried out by you, practiced, developed, and cultivated, so that this holy life, what you call Buddhism, or the Dharma, whatever you want to call it, may endure for a long time. There may be for the benefit and happiness of the multitude out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of babies and humans. It's a very wise thing not to give the power to one person. Because if you cut the head off the snake, the rest of the snake goes. But the snake has got no head, every part of it is the head. It's so difficult to stop. We have no leader. The Dharma is our leader. It's like a virus, which has no one origin, so it's infected all the computers in the world. So it's hard actually to eradicate possibly. So that's why the Dharma infected all the minds of human beings. Some people realize that, some people don't. They will soon. It's crashing the system. The system of craving and materialism. Really, it's subversive. Anyway, all this I'll put this in here, which is important from the Samyutta Nikaya. Because sometimes people every now and again they come up and say, the Buddha actually has some more teachings which he never revealed to his close disciples at that time because they weren't intelligent enough. But they hid them in the Naga realm. Or they have been secretly transmitted from student to disciple, secretly until now. Every now and again you come across this Gomaya. But this is what the Buddha said, to stop all that silliness. He said, which do you think are greater, the few leaves that I hold in my hand, or the leaves in the forest? Asked the Buddha. The leaves in the forest, came the obvious answer. Likewise, the things that I know but I have not taught are many, like the leaves in the forest. Whereas the things that I have taught you are few, like the leaves in my hand. So he didn't actually teach that much. Many more things he knew that he never revealed. But the reason I have not taught you these things is because they are irrelevant to the holy life and do not lead to enlightenment. So anything which you don't find in those teachers, the Buddha is saying is irrelevant, it doesn't lead to enlightenment. He took out all of the rubbish which is not helpful and just taught all what is helpful. So anything which wasn't taught by the Buddha, yeah, it's useful, but not for the purpose of enlightenment. Is that it? Oh, graduate training. Okay, that's a whole different form of my issue. Read out tomorrow, such it all up in a different way. But there it is, 10 minutes before we get to tea time. Okay, are there any questions? That's very powerful deep drama, but why can't I teach you? Yes, honey.
The oneness of mind and the
the oneness of mighty unity of mind. Go to the Pali word that's called ekagata. Eka means one. Aga is what many people call unity, but it means much more than that. Ta is just, you know, what we say in English, any goddess, ness. They get happy in happiness. It turns an adjective into an abstract noun. So ekagata is one aga, ness. So the best way you can understand what the word aga means is in its Sanskrit equivalent. Aga is Pali. The Sanskrit equivalent is called agra. And straight away that should ring a bell, that that is the Mughal capital of India, where you find the Taj Mahal and the Red Fort, because that was the peak city in the time of the Mughal Empire in India. Agra doesn't mean just oneness, it means a peak, a summit, a capital of experience. It's not just oneness, it's one huge coming together, peak of the mind. And that is actually experientially what happens. You get into, say, a first jhana. First time you get into a first jhana, afterwards you think, this is the peak of experience. You can't have anything more than this. And that's why some people think it's enlightenment, or it's union with God, or, you know, union with the Absolute. Sometimes that happens to people in the outer body experience. They go into the light, they merge with the Absolute. And the way people experience, remember, that incredible happiness and bliss, I know some people perceive it as pure love. Total peace, you don't have to achieve anything or be anything, you're totally loving, you totally disappear, merging with pure love, pure bliss. It's not two separate experiences, it's exactly the same. So a lot of times people do that and they think that's union with the God. They're not separate anymore. They're just one. But one, not just only one, one huge peak. And the weirdest thing, after you come out of the first round, you think, wow, that was amazing, that was incredible, you can't get more than that. But then, next time, you go to the second round, you can get more than absolute happiness. And you start to wonder, what more is there? And there's more. So that's one of the things, there's many, many peaks in the mountain range for deep meditation.
So do you use unity and oneness of mind
interchangeably? Yes, exactly. Oneness, unity. It means the same. Yes. Language changes with the ages, and the meaning of words changes with the times. An obvious word is the word gay. If maybe in the Second World War somebody said they had a gay weekend, it didn't mean they were homosexual, they just had some happiness and joy. But now if you say you had a gay party, it would mean homosexual. So words change with time, and that can date written texts. Now one of the people who did that was this Professor A.K. Warder, who wrote a classic called Indian Buddhism. And his whole task then, you know, he said he wasn't really a Buddhist, he was just an academic, a professor at Cambridge in Southeast, in Indian studies. And he was an expert especially on poetry, because poetry changes, it's like music changes, and you can date music very easily. And so that he could pretty much date what was early, what was late. So that's one strand where you can date an ancient text by the language which is used. Also you can date it by the geography, because there are archaeologists who can see whether a town existed at that time or whether it was abandoned at that time. You have archaeological evidence. And then you also have, I forget what the other evidence is, which they looked at, but a whole series of these things which individually they could not prove beyond reasonable doubt that that was the original word of the Buddha. But little by little you put them all together and it becomes a very convincing case of what was the original teaching of the Buddha and what was later. And if you look at that, it becomes quite clear that what you have, you know, in the Pali scriptures, excluding the Abhidhamma, that was clearly later, and even some of the Sutta. I already mentioned the Satipatthana Sutta. The earliest part just had two sections in the fourth Satipatthana on the mind objects or dhammas, and that was just the five emphases and the seven mind factors. The others were added afterwards. They were not wrong, but they weren't really original. They were obviously added after the time of the Buddha. There's a lot of stuff like that, which marks, it has to be Western marks, because if a Taiwan did that, they would be criticized. If a Burmese monk did that, they would have to leave the country. Even when I was in Sri Lanka, I'm well known in Sri Lanka, there are a few Sri Lankans here. I've got a lot of credibility in Sri Lanka. When I went on TV there and said the Buddha never taught the Abhidhamma, many of us said, thank goodness you could say that. We all know that, but we can't say it. So we have to live in this country. You're leaving next week. So sometimes, you know, to be able to tell the truth, sometimes you upset too many people. But, you know, I'm in a position to be able to do that. I'm not really upset. Everybody knows those things, but they don't say it. So it's great we can actually find out what the Buddha really taught. And when you find out, if you really want to see this, it's called the Authenticity Project. Authenticity Project. And Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Bhavani were the ringleaders of that, and they're very altruistic, so they don't want to print it and sell it. So it's just on the internet, so anyone can get free access to it. But you know that my books I sell. It's not to get the money, it's to get the distribution, get it spread. If anything for free in modern day is not valued. So even this, you know, what you've seen here, just a sample of my retranslation of the word of the Buddha. Many of you have asked and will ask, can I get a copy of this? And I can give you a copy for personal use, but I don't want to publish it as for free. I want to sell it simply because then more people will get access to it. And Ajahn Mumbai's and Sujata's authenticity project is a case in point. Really a piece of work that you probably didn't even know it existed. It's not on the tables in the back there, but I'm perfectly content. And good, bad, who knows? Because it's for free. That's the problem. So anyway, that's how we know it's authentic. Yeah?
But then, would you know what stage you've reached if you have the Dharma?
That's a very good question. The stage you reach, say, if you've got a Dharma, the stage of your deep meditation. It's difficult to not exactly know. Limiters are very clear. It's a beautiful light in the mind. And frankly, this is anecdotal of all the years I've been teaching meditation. I don't know how many times people have come up to me and say, I saw a light, but it can't be a limiter. Well, not again. That was a limiter. I don't know why it is people see lights and think, no, I can't be me, not me. They weren't ever. 99% of the time when people think they've seen a limiter and they doubt it, 99% of the time it actually is a limiter. You've got one. Not long, but it was. So why do people doubt so much? But somehow or other, maybe because of other monks say, you know, real meditation is for monks and for nuns, not for you guys. You're lay people. Your job is just to feed the monks and make them fat. That's your job in life. You do a pretty good job. You're supposed to be walking this path as well. So yes, you can do it. You do get limiters. My mom said, but yeah, that's a limiter. When it gets to the jhanas, I am the toughest examiner of the jhanas. Because I forget what book it was, I don't have much time to read the books. Ah, there was a book on Samadhi and jhanas written recently, and they compared five teachers. Who is the most strict and demanding to approve that yes, you have a jhana? You can ask one monk and say, yeah, there was. Another one said, no way. Of the contemporary teachers, the easiest, the lowest standards were from Ayurveda. So what she said was a jhana was, was not that demanding. The second highest was heart oxide. If you tell him your experiences and he says, well, that was a jhana, then that's pretty pretty sure. But the most demanding modern meditation teachers was none other than the one you see in front of you, Ajahn Brahm. In other words, the hardest monk to ask, was it a jhana or not, is me. That's very bad, okay. Stop! It's nothing. The weird little big table. But what it means if I take this account, if I confirm it, then all the other ones will. I'm the toughest. So I don't say you've got the time recently. It doesn't matter. Because you get first round, it's got a long way to go. It's there goes some more. It's good, excellent, well done, carry on. And then go even more. But frankly, the second jhana is the easiest one to recognize. That's just a giveaway. This, nothing is moving. Absolutely still. And the other little things afterwards, you're really, how can you explain what it's like? The nearest simile, but it's a long way away from it. But it reminded me that sometimes you meet a friend and they just fallen in love. I said, I've met this girl. Oh, she's so perfect. I'm so happy. Just thinking about her just gives me so much joy. I mean, love. I don't know if you've ever been in love. I've seen other people in love. They're really crazy. Look this down. Now imagine that time of a hundred. That's like coming out of town. Oh,
becomes so nice.
It's like being in love, only much more. That's the emotional afterglow is used. So that's how you understand. If you come up and say, yeah, that's first John. No way. And honestly, I'll tell you all my tricks, I shouldn't really do this, but I won't look at your body language. Not what you say. You didn't say all sorts of stuff. Yeah, I saw a beautiful light, I emerged in this light, and I was wondering all things. And I was looking at your body language. And have you really got that afterglow, that bliss, incredible joy? That's pretty easy to tell. If you have that, then okay, I'm taking you seriously. That's how you know. Anyway, yes, a question over there. Yeah. Sati Sampajanya. Sati is mindfulness, and it's usually used just for awareness. What I did mention is also used in many places as memory as well. Remembering what you're supposed to be doing. And really, it should be Sati plus Sampajanya. Ajahn Chah would always say Sati Panya. Mindfulness, wisdom. Sampajanya is another word for wisdom. Pajanya, you shorten that, as a compound, it becomes panya. Pajanya, panya, the same thing. Sam means just with. It's with panya. With wisdom. That's what sampajanya means. With wisdom. So sati, you're mindful, but with wisdom. An example of this, just to end up in a nice, funny way, and one of my little funny stories. The story of the wealthy woman in Singapore who went on a retreat in Phuket for 6 or 7 days. And because she was wealthy, and because there are burglars in Singapore, and because she had a guard, a doorkeeper on her house, she told the doorkeeper, be mindful, there are thieves. I'm going away for a few days. Be very mindful in case of the thieves. And when she comes back after the retreat, she finds her house has been burgled. And so she's very upset at her doorkeeper. I told you to be mindful, you stupid doorkeeper, you stupid guard. I've been burgled. And the guard said, madam, I was mindful, I did have sati. I saw the burglars going in, and I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking out your safe. I noted safe going out, safe going out, safe going out. I noticed them going in again for your jewelry. I saw them going in, going in, going in. I saw jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, the rise and fall of all your wealth. I saw all of that. I was very mindful. That is not the job of a gatekeeper. Not just mindfulness, but with wisdom. Know the purpose of what your job is. Yeah, be mindful, but be wise as well. So if a burglar comes in, call please, or do something. That is mindfulness with Sampajanya. Just bare mindfulness is not enough. Mindfulness with wisdom. So, if you see a thought coming into your mind to steal away your peace, you see it coming, but be wise. What should I do? Or not do? And you can say, make peace, be kind, be gentle, and that should eliminate the thought. Or find the strategic means. It's not just being mindful, it's just being wise as well. Thank you for that question. Yeah? Oh, that's even in neuroscience does that. If you pay attention, then the memory is very strong. one time you really pay attention is if you think your life's in danger. You have a traumatic experience. People who have a car crash, they think they're going to die. They have flashbacks. Because it's seared, branded into your memory. Why? Because when you think you're going to die, you are really mindful. Incredibly mindful. And that's also one of the reasons why people, you know, I say this, why do people spend all this money going to this theme park where you have death drops, where you get turned upside down? And you just basically, it's torture in these theme parks. You know, where you do daredevil tricks, wrapped in upside down, going really fast. Because you have to be mindful, because adrenaline kicks in. You think that somehow you're really scared. You get aware, but all with that powerful awareness is also a sense of joy and happiness as well. Why do people drive fast bikes and cars? What's the happiness in that? The fear gives rise to really powerful mindfulness, and with it some happiness as well. You can do that here without getting into danger. So, when you are really aware, that's when you have good memory. I always had a good memory, so I did well at school without doing much work. I can remember things the teacher said. It wasn't like a photographic memory, it was just a good memory, and for years I didn't know why. It's only when you got into Buddhism you realised that I would pay attention to the teachers. When they were talking, I wasn't daydreaming. I wasn't sort of thinking of, you know, when maybe the lesson's going to finish and I'm going to play soccer. I would actually listen to what the teacher was saying. And I had mindfulness. And because of that, I remember stuff easily. That's why mindfulness training for children means that you learn much easier. You don't need to force the mind to remember. You make the mind perfectly still and calm. Not perfectly, that's jarring. But really still. Not thinking. No inner conversation. You soak up what it happens. Make it important, like the emphasis of questions. Pay attention. And in neuroscience, they say the neural connection is made. You make the links, you make the synapse. That's actually how we learn. Everything is done mindfully, with full awareness, it makes a connection in your brain. Oh yeah, it's memories of byproducts, because sometimes there's too many things to remember. When you get lazy in old age, you get, people say lazy, it's like efficiency. So why don't you remember everybody's name? It's impossible. So that's why my trick is when somebody comes up to me, you remember me? I saw you in Colombo 5 years ago, in that big talking over 10,000 people. They see you and they forget that, you know, that I'm in the centre of the stage and there's 10,000 people out there. So I always say to them, I remember you. You know what, I'm offending people. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting. But I thought it was true. So that way you don't have to be embarrassing. It didn't even happen. I saw this, somebody wrote about this, when the first George Bush became President of the United States. George Bush the first. And he went to a reception in London. And there's reporters there, obviously. This woman came up to him and said, "No, I'm Sir Mary Smith. Who are you?" Said it to the President of the United States. And George Bush said, "I'm the President of the United States." He said, "Come off it. Who are you really?" It was real, she didn't know who he was. And, you know, he thought it was his fault because, you know, he needed to do a bit more PR before he goes into foreign countries. Well, that was really cool if he didn't know who he was. Anyway, it's now 5:15, so we finish up now. Anymore, there's actually four questions over there. Any questions over this side? Round the back. in the middle? Great, let's have a cup of tea. So we put the questions in for this evening. Please apologize if I think I'm going too deep with this meditation and jhanas, but it's only because I respect you. And I want to treat you like monks. Okay, so you may not understand it, but one day you will. So, beautiful. Thank you for listening. Sadhu.
Sadhu.